It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Did you happen to catch the little press gig with our Governor Gary Locke over in Mabton, saying that declaring all beef in the U.S. was safe? You missed that, didn't you?
I did.
That's because you're not plugged in.
Sometimes anyway, I wonder if Gary Locke is plugged in.
Oh, he's plugged in.
His brain's been eaten away for years.
Yeah, it was
beef.
Amazing.
It's what's for dinner.
Yeah, I think I'm going to skip dinner tonight.
Yeah, then. Brains. It's what's for dinner if you're a little one of those little proteins that is prions or whatever they're called. Brains. It's what's for dinner.
All right. Well, let's jump into this week's topic. Speaking of brains, our chief brain there in D.C. was
The big guy.
The big guy. He was celebrating MLK.
Yeah, he certainly was. He's. God, has there been any spectacle more nauseating than George W. Bush on Martin Luther King's 75th birthday? Virtually locking in conference attendees to Ebenezer Baptist Church while he goes out and the Secret Service did while he goes out and stands by Martin Luther King's grave and. No doubt spits on it as he's contemplating nominating Charles Pickering to the Supreme Court, which I'll talk about in a moment. But it did make me wonder, you know, what George Bush's dream is. You know,
I
have a dream when all the rich little black children and all the rich little white children go to the same private schools. You know,
I have a dream. All my descendants will be able to escape a dying planet and go to Mars.
Yes, I have a dream that my nanny, who's in the country on a legal 6-year work permit, won't have to sit in the back of the bus when she goes home at night. I mean, it's pretty nauseating, but. So he's going in and pimping MLK's. Birthday, and I have a column up on workingforchange.com at the moment talking about how if were King alive today, he would be called a terrorist, basically, and, you know, be harassed by a government that has foreign FBI that has far more sweeping powers now than it did in the 50s and 60s when it came after him. And, you know, we forget in the sanitized MLK holiday just how radical a vision he had and how that it tied in not just to having a dream and to civil rights, but also economic issues and poverty and labor and being anti-war and specifically anti-imperialist and anti-colonialist because he saw the U.S. as fighting all of these wars in countries with brown people. Funny thing, huh? Here we are 40 years later doing essentially the same thing. And there are several important MLK Day events that we want to make sure and get to at the end of the program, and also talking about Bert Sachs next week.
Why don't we just mention those now?
Okay, and then I want to make sure for people get their pencils and papers because I have some stuff on Bert Sachs I want to talk about at the end of the program too.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a couple MLK things going on that are worth mentioning. One of them is already starting over in Kitsap County this morning, the annual MLK event at Ground Zero at the Bangor Nuclear Weapons Naval Base in Bangor, Washington. The folks from Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, who really in this area are the direct spiritual activist descendants of Martin Luther King in terms of their use of nonviolent civil disobedience. They're having basically an all-day event out at the gates of the gates of the Bangor base in Poolesbo, Washington.
You mean the gates of the world's largest depository of nuclear weapons?
Yeah, that's the one. And if you need directions to get out there, a phone number to call would be, I don't know if the person at area code 206 is going to be home this morning, but you can try it in Kitsap County, area code 360-297-3804. On January 17th, actually, excuse me, another number to call, 360-779-4672. And I'll give that again at the end of the program for people who didn't get it. And then on Monday here in Seattle, there's the annual MLK Day workshops in the morning at Garfield High School, and then a march at noon, and the theme today being being one of domestic programs, and you know, economic equality begins at home, something that I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot about when President Bush gives his State of the Rich, Wealthy White Landowners Union speech on Tuesday evening, which incidentally, to segue into another topic, he's expected in that speech to make a make another sweeping new health proposal that is expected to cost billions and billions and billions of dollars to help the country's uninsured and underinsured. Obviously, as with Medicare, it's a fair bet that whatever the shape of the proposal is, that most of the money that is spent by the federal government will go into the pockets of probably in this case insurance companies and HMOs and the companies that that set up and dispense drugs to the different companies, pharmaceuticals, that is. It's amazing how, particularly in election year, this president seems to think money grows on trees. It is something, once again, that's going to affect the economy of this country, because it's money that simply doesn't exist. As with the probed Mars that we'll be able to send his descendants to Mars on.
That's right. just talking for a minute about the federal deficit, we don't always realize what the federal deficit is. It's basically a large line of credit for the government.
Yeah, aside from the fact that it didn't exist 3 years ago.
That's right. Well, it was going down, and we had a surplus for a year or two.
Yeah, but the budget in each per year had the deficit had disappeared, but the national debt still existed.
Mm-hmm. And that large line of credit, someone has to finance. So that means someone has to buy those treasury bonds and bills that are issued by the U.S. government. Now, a large number of the people who buy those treasury bonds and bills are foreign investors. In fact, there are far more foreign investors in U.S. Treasury debt than there are U.S. investors these days.
And that's where a lot of the money that fueled the boom in the 90s came from.
Right. And it's because a lot of foreign investors see or have seen in the past U.S. government debt as a very safe and very good investment. Now, that was particularly true when other investments around the world were pretty volatile. And nowadays, that has also been true to a certain extent. Some national governments see the U.S. government debt as very safe. However, many foreign investors who lost their shirt during the bust, the recent stock market bust, and there were a lot of them, have started to look at the U.S. economy and say, well, it's not looking so firm. It's not looking so steady. And they've been pulling their money out. That's one of the reasons we've seen a big drop in the value of the dollar. If that continues, if foreign investors continue to pull out their money, now that a lot of them pull out their money because of the drop in the dollar, because the little bit of interest that they earn on U.S. government debt, when you start to translate that into their own national currency, because the dollar has dropped and keeps dropping, that means they actually get less return than they had expected when they first buy those treasury securities. So it basically, the drop in the dollar erodes the value of their investment over time. Now, if foreign investors look at that and they start pulling their money out, the value of the dollar will drop precipitously, and that'll have a very, very bad impact on the U.S. economy.
Yeah, and the flip side of that, well, there's a couple of flip sides. One is that the Bush administration is claiming that these deficits don't matter because the economic growth that they will fuel will cover the debt, basically, that the money coming in.
It'll lead to corporate profits that will increase revenue.
But a lot of these foreign investors are seeing, and what most serious economic analysts are also seeing, is that those assumptions of the Bush administration as to future economic growth are basically cooked books. That they're they're based on very, very shaky assumptions. However, one of the reasons why the massive federal deficit doesn't bother these same fiscal conservatives who were screaming for the heads of the Clinton administration in its early years because of the federal debt, they're now forgetting all of that. But one of the reasons that they're forgetting all of that is very basic and very political, which is that, you know, when you have all of this interest accruing on the national debt, that interest goes somewhere. It goes to banks, and it goes to banks that are, in most cases, fairly large donors to the Republican Party. So, you know, there are people who are getting rich off of the national debt, and it's not the taxpayers. It's not you and I, and it's not our kids and our grandkids. It's one more of those wealth transfers that that Dr. King would have decried were he alive.
Talk about Charles Pickering.
He is a judge from the great state of Mississippi who has served on the bench. He is the man who was appointed to the federal bench, and it's a power that presidents have and usually have used in the past, and is being used again this time to get the most controversial judges onto the court, that when Congress is not in session, the president can appoint a judge to the federal bench for a one-year term. And that, of course, in this case, would go through the next election. And once these appointments are made, however, it's extremely rare that they are not subsequently ratified by the Senate. Once a guy is on the bench, he's not going to come off the bench. It simply doesn't happen. Mr. Pickering has a number of questionable questionable racial rulings in his past, and not just his distant past. When in the 50s and 60s, he was an enthusiastic advocate of Jim Crow. Some of his more recent rulings that have troubled people include commuting a sentence in the mid 90s of a gentleman who had been sentenced to a number of years in prison for his help in burning a cross on the lawn of an interracial couple in Mississippi. He's made a number of public statements that call into question his commitment to desegregation. I mean, the idea, and this is an appointment that was held up by Senate Democrats, and one of the few things that have actually fought for over the last 2 years. It was held up by Democrats because they saw this appointment as, you know, the man as being so not just conservative, but inappropriate for the bench because of his both written and his written record and his judicial rulings. Having Bush appoint him to the federal bench at all is appalling. Having him doing it on the heel of going to Georgia, visiting the grave, and doing it on the weekend of MLK's birthday is just the kind of appalling obliviousness to the actual heritage of King that it's a symbolism that absolutely should not be missed by anybody who cares about racial justice in this country.
Mm. But the fact that it happens on a weekend, you know, generally.
Well, this is yet another. I mean, look in the news on Fridays, because Fridays is when this White House buries the news. It does not right. want to get much attention.
And
it happens every week.
Yeah, and I think the Bush administration, they plan these things. They knew ahead of time that George Bush was going to appoint Pickering, and they said, well, gosh, we'll have him do it the same weekend that he goes and visits MLK's grave, and will be a big press opportunity, and it'll mask the other.
Well, and not only that, but it'll soften the image. They see it as, you know, if he visits King's grave, people will think, well, gosh, maybe he's not such a bad guy after all. Maybe he really understands and cares about the plight of African Americans. He doesn't. I mean, this was a photo op, just like landing on the deck of the aircraft carrier and all of the other things. Don't look at what the photo op is. Look at what he does.
Right. But to be fair, White House, you know, who's ever in the White House generally does use weekends for doing the bad news.
It's been a long tradition. much more pronounced under the Bush administration.
A lot of things have been more pronounced.
Yeah, no kidding. Words not being one of them, but.
All right. Well, if we're done with that, we can move on to this week in Iraq. What have you got for us this week, Maria?
Two things this week for Iraq. There were
Iraq.
There were riots in southern Shiite cities of Amara and Kut this week. In Amara, a crowd gathered at the provincial government headquarters on Saturday demanding jobs that the Coalition Provisional Authority had promised to deliver by the beginning of January, but those jobs have not materialized. Iraqi police opened fire on the crowd, killing 6 people and wounding at least a dozen. The crowd then chased the Iraqi police nearly out of town, and British troops had to intervene in order to stop the violence. Now, this also begs the question of how the Iraqi police will be able to handle matters once the U.S. military and its coalition partners leave the country. Protesters marched for 3 days straight in the city of Kut to also demand jobs. They hurled grenades at Iraqi police and threw bricks at government buildings, and they also trashed a post office. Shiites, our allies in Iraq, were deeply impoverished during Saddam Hussein's regime, and the lack of jobs now has just made them increasingly desperate. Now, a doctor who had watched the demonstrations in Kut told a reporter, quote, "These people are not terrorists, but they are desperate enough to die." That's the situation among the Shiite majority population in Iraq. Now, on Thursday, 30,000 Shiites protested in the streets of Basra, Iraq's second largest city. But they weren't demanding jobs. They were angry about the U.S.'s plan to select members for a new interim legislature in Iraq that will take over in June, instead of letting Iraqis actually elect their representatives. Now, on Sunday, Iraq's leading Shiite cleric, the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, had warned that he might issue a fatwa demanding direct elections. He has supported direct elections all along.
And been very vocal about it also.
That's right. And this could lead to more unrest in southern Iraq. Now, the protest in Basra is just a taste of what could happen in the future if the U.S. completely ignores al-Sistani. The Shiites want elections, just to remind folks, and the Shiites want elections because they're the majority population in Iraq. And they also believe that the returning exiles have too much influence over Paul Bremer, the U.S. viceroy in Iraq. They think that the Caucasus are being stacked, and there is some evidence that they're being stacked by supporters of these returning exile groups, and that will lock out many of the Shiite candidates. Now, the U.S. doesn't want elections because it fears that Muslim fundamentalists will take power, and they're also aware that the Shiites have a close relationship to Iran, which is a majority Shiite nation. But alienating the majority of Iraqis and our allies in Iraq is extremely perilous. So far, al-Sistani has refused to meet with any U.S. representatives, but he's also promised not to declare a jihad or promote violence in Iraq among the Shiite population. But there are younger, more radical Muslim clerics among the Shiites who would be willing to do that, and that's what the U.S. is risking by ignoring al-Sistani.
And several of them have substantial followings also. These are not people who are sort of fringe elements in Iraqi politics or religion.
Mm-hmm. Now, Paul Bremer was called back to Washington, D.C. this week to meet with President Bush on Thursday to explain what's going on with the Shiites in Iraq and to review the U.S.'s plan and time frame for putting a new government in place by June. Now, that's a time frame that al-Sistani and his aides have pointed out is geared more towards helping George Bush win re-election than actually putting in a new democratic representative government in Iraq or ensuring the security of the Iraqi nation. We'll see if any changes come out of these desperate meetings between Bremer and Bush and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell in this coming weekend.
Yeah, and if Paul O'Neill was to believe it, I mean, Bush probably wasn't even paying that much attention. I mean, he's probably sitting there and nodding.
No, it's probably Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice who are doing most of the work in these meetings. Now, on Monday, Bremer is going to travel to New York. Paul Bremer is going to travel to New York to meet with the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and members of the Iraqi Governing Council in order to discuss ways to slightly democratize the selection process in Iraq. Now, the Bush administration is trying to persuade Kofi Annan and the UN to bring the UN back into Iraq. And the UN's role in Iraq will be to act as a tool of the Coalition Provisional Authority in persuading the Shiites to accept the selection process instead of an election process, and to persuade the Kurdish minority to not demand autonomy in northern Iraq.
How can Kofi turn that one down?
I know. So far, Kofi Annan has shown a distinct lack of enthusiasm for that role. And we can't blame him. So that's what's going to be going on Monday. That's also another reason for Bremer to be in the States right now. Meanwhile, the U.S.'s hand-picked representatives in Iraq, the Governing Council, voted on December 29th in a secret meeting closed to the public on a ruling. They voted in a ruling that was just announced this week, that Iraq was to scrap its secular family law code, the most progressive in the Middle East, and replace it with Sharia law. This was a shocker. The family law code allows women to be free of arbitrary divorce, to have property rights and inheritance rights equal to those of men, and it grants them custody rights of their children after a divorce. It also prohibits men from having multiple wives, and it bans marriage for girls under 18. That it is the most progressive family law code in Arabic Middle Eastern countries. Now, Sharia or religious law would do away with most, if not all, of these protections. Hundreds of Iraqi women turned out in the streets of Baghdad to protest on Tuesday when this decision was finally leaked. It wasn't really announced. It was leaked to some female members of the government. And women civil servants in the Iraqi government are contemplating going on strike because of this decision. Now, this decision can't go into effect unless Paul Bremer gives his okay. He's sort of like the president of Iraq right now. But he's only going to be in power until June 30th, after which things could change very drastically and Iraqi women could lose most of their rights under Iraqi law. That was an absolute shocker.
Yeah. By the way, on this anniversary of Colin Powell's totally fictitious address to the United Nations, there was another interesting Iraq tidbit this week, which is that John Dean apparently is coming out with a new book. The former White House counsel during the Nixon era, who was so heavily involved in Watergate, and the book apparently argues that the Bush and a guy who is still a fairly prominent lawyer in Republican circles, and the book apparently argues that, or will argue that, the Bush administration's selling of the Iraqi war to the American public, and particularly its lying around weapons of mass destruction, is a breach of the Constitution that was worse than Watergate, and that the Bush should be impeached.
Mm-hmm.
So that, on the heels of Paul O'Neill's interviews and book last week, suggests that it's more than those fringe Bush haters out there in the vast wasteland of America who are finding this administration's conduct to be beyond the pale.
All right, sticking tangentially with Iraq, I understand Halliburton stocks should be doing okay this week. They should be recovering.
Foreign investors are flocking.
Yes, indeed. One of the other main issues to look at in Iraq is where the U.S. is spending that $20 billion that's going to for reconstruction projects in Iraq. Now, on Wednesday, the Defense Department, which is the Defense Department auditing agency, has been conducting a review of Halliburton's gas sales in Iraq. So as part of a no-bid contract that Halliburton was awarded by the Bush administration early last year in Iraq, Halliburton has been importing gasoline into the country in order to keep the fuel supplies steady for the Iraqi people. Now, there were charges that Halliburton was charging double the cost of the gasoline the actual cost of the gasoline to bring it into the country, and that was way more than they should be charging. Now, on Wednesday, the Defense Department's top auditor in the auditing agency asked the Pentagon's Inspector General to open a criminal investigation of Halliburton's Kellogg Brown and Root subsidiary for overcharging for gas. Now, essentially, that means the auditors were saying that they've reached the limits of what they can do by examining all the paperwork that they've looked at, and that they suspect that there was some criminal activity going on there when Halliburton chose the Kuwaiti subcontractor to do this project for them. Now, in spite of this development, the Pentagon went ahead on Friday and re-awarded Halliburton the contract to rebuild Iraq's oil industry. Now, they had originally won this as a no-bid contract last year, and the contract was supposed to be competitively bid out in the fall so that other companies could submit bids and compete with Halliburton for this contract. But the Pentagon kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off, accepting the bids and then putting off awarding the contract. And this was in the face of Halliburton's competitors complaining, gosh, the longer these Halliburton is in the country, the less likely we're going to be able to submit a competitive bid. Now, finally, in January, when the Pentagon has awarded the contract, they just went ahead and said, okay, Halliburton has it now. They can add this $1.2 billion contract to the more than $2 billion that the Pentagon has already paid them and probably has overpaid them for their no-bid contract in Iraq. Now, this is not the only scandal going on regarding the awarding of contracts. A U.S. company won the contract to manage Iraq's state media system. Harris Corporation will run two TV channels, two radio channels, and a daily newspaper in Iraq. This $100 million contract was awarded by the Pentagon, and it is due to run for one full year, which means that a U.S. company will then be running Iraqi state media even after a new Iraqi government takes over in June. Now, an aide to the Republican Senator Richard Lugar, who chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said, quote, "We don't want U.S. taxpayers paying $100 million for some new Iraqi government over there to take over."
Wait a minute, that was the point, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Some to of us might
have
say
have a new that. Iraqi government take over?
Yeah, some of us might say that that was the point of the whole invasion, was to put a new Iraqi government in power and have them take over. But apparently that was not the point. Now, not content with just running the Iraqi state media, the U.S. government is also setting up an FM radio station south of Baghdad with money collected from Iraqi oil sales. Now, what is Iraqi public money buying? The new station will compete with local radio stations that run a lot of religious broadcasting geared to the Shiite majority population. The Washington Post calls this, quote, "the latest move in the broader, sometimes faltering effort to present the viewpoints of the United States and the provisional authority."
So they're going to run the 700 Club instead, right?
Right, and it's going to be paid for with money from Iraqi oil sales.
All right.
Okay, can I get a word about Bert Sachs in before
I would appreciate if you would.
Okay. Yeah, we just have a minute left or so, and I will give that the phone number for the Ground Zero thing today again in a minute. But also coming up next week, and it's on Saturday morning right after the program, there's a breakfast fundraiser going on. So make your plans now, and you can also find out information on the web about it now. Bert Sachs, who's been on this station many times, and we've talked about him, he's a longtime Iraq activist, been to Iraq many times, just filed a lawsuit, actually, over the State Department. So the Treasury Department's rather fining of him of $10,000 for his trips to Iraq to deliver humanitarian goods and aids. He had a heart attack in December. Is recuperating nicely at home, but because he is uninsured, because he's been a full-time activist working to break the sanctions and then stop the war, he has been hit with something like $57,000 in medical bills. So to try and offset that, some of us in the community are having an event for him next Saturday to raise money. And there's also going to be a silent auction. The auction items also will be up on a website. And you can also make donations over the website, even by credit card. The website is www.bertmedicalfund.org. It's B-E-R-T, Bert. medicalfund.org. You know, he does not have many resources and has been doing amazing work over the last decade or so. So this is a way for the community to say its thanks for the work that Bert has been doing.
You can also RSVP through that website.
Yes, because they'll need to know how many people are coming for breakfast. It's next week at 10:30, I believe, at United Temple, United Methodist Church at 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District. And again, that information is all at www.bertmedicalfund.org. So there's that. There's also the Ground Zero MLK actions out at
the
Bangor Base. And the phone number for that, if you need directions to get out there, it's going on right now. It's area code
4672.
And again on Monday during MLK Day, workshops in the morning and march at noon from Garfield High School.
All right. With that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. And very quickly, how can people contact Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, anywhere there are free publications around town.
Anywhere you have a dream.
You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to comment on anything you heard on this program, you can give us a call at 206-903-9461.